Our reading's taken from 1 Samuel, chapter 25. It's a long chapter, so I hope you're sitting comfortably. 1 Samuel, chapter 25, David, Nabal, and Abigail. Now Samuel died, and all Israel assembled and mourned for him. And they buried him at his home in Ramah. And then David moved down into the desert of Paran. A certain man in Maon, who had property there at Carmel, was very wealthy. He had 1,000 goats and 3,000 sheep, which he was shearing at Carmel. His name was Nabal, and his wife's name was Abigail. She was an intelligent and beautiful woman, but her husband was surly and mean in his dealings. He was a Calebite. While David was in the wilderness, he heard that Nabal was shearing sheep, so he sent 10 young men and said to them, "Go up to Carmel and greet him in my name. Say to him, 'Long live to you, long life to you, good health to you, and your household, and good health to all that is yours. Now I hear that it is shearing time. When your shepherds were with us, we did not mistreat them, and the whole time they were at Carmel, nothing of theirs was missing. Ask your own servants, and they will tell you. Therefore be favourable toward my men, since we come at festive time. Please give your servants and your son David whatever you can find for them.' When David's men arrived, they gave Nabal this message in David's name. Then they waited. Nabal answered David's servants, 'Who is this David? Who is this son of Jesse? Many servants are breaking away from their masters these days. Why should I take my bread and water and the meat I have slaughtered for my shearers and give it to men coming from who knows where?' David's men turned around and went back. And when they arrived, they reported every word. David said to his men, 'Each of you, strap on your sword.' So they did. And David strapped on his own as well. About 400 men went up with David, while 200 stayed with the supplies. One of the servants told Abigail, Nabal's wife, 'David sent messengers from the wilderness to give our master his greetings, but he hurled insults at them. Yet these men were very good to us. They did not mistreat us, and the whole time we were out in the fields near them, so nothing was missing. Night and day, there were a wall around us the whole time we were herding our sheep near them. Now think it over and see what you can do, because disaster is hanging over our master and his whole household. He's such a wicked man and no one can talk to him.' Abigail acted quickly. She took 200 loaves of bread, 2 skins of wine, 5 dressed sheep, 5 seers of roast grain, and 100 cakes of raisins and 200 cakes of pressed figs, and loaded them on donkeys. Then she told her servants, 'Go on ahead, I will follow you.' But she did not tell her husband Nabal. As she came riding her donkey into a mountain ravine, there were David and his men descending toward her, and she met them. David had just said, "It's been useless, all my watching over this fellow's property in the wilderness, so that nothing of his was missing, and he paid me back evil for good. May God deal with David, be it ever so severely, if by morning I leave alive one male of all who belong to him." When Abigail saw David, she quickly got off her donkey and bowed before David, her face to the ground. She fell at his feet and said, "Pardon your servant, my lord, and let me speak to you. Hear what your servant has to say. Please pay no attention, my lord, to that wicked man Nabal. He is just like his name. His name means fool, and folly goes with him. As for me, your servant, I did not see the men my lord sent. And now, my lord, as surely as the Lord your God lives, and as you live, since the Lord has kept you from bloodshed and from avenging yourself with your own hands, may your enemies and all who are intent on harming my lord be like Nabal. And let this gift which your servant has brought to my lord be given to the men who follow you. Please forgive your servant's presumption. The Lord your God will certainly make a lasting dynasty for my lord, because you fight the Lord's battles, and no wrongdoing will be found in you as long as you live. Even though someone is pursuing you to take your life, the life of my lord will be bound securely in a bundle of the living by the Lord your God. But the lives of your enemies he will hurl away as from the pocket of a sling. When the Lord has fulfilled for my lord every good thing he promised concerning him and has anointed him ruler over Israel, my lord will not have on his conscience the staggering burden of needless bloodshed or of having avenged himself. And when the Lord your God has brought my lord success, remember your servant." David said to Abigail, "Praise be to the Lord, the God of Israel, who has sent you today to meet me. May you be blessed for your good judgment and for keeping me from bloodshed this day and for avenging myself with my own hands. Otherwise, as surely as the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, who has kept me from harming you, if you had not come quickly to meet me, not one male belonging to Nabal would have been left alive by daybreak." Then David accepted from her hand what she had brought him and said, "Go in peace. I have heard your words and granted your request." When Abigail went to Nabal, he was in the house holding a banquet like that of a king. He was in high spirits and very drunk, so she told him nothing at all until daybreak. Then in the morning, when Nabal was sober, his wife told him all these things, and his heart failed him, and he became like a stone. About 10 days later, the Lord struck Nabal, and he died. When David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, "Praise be to the Lord, who has upheld my cause against Nabal for treating me with contempt. He has kept his servant from doing wrong and has brought Nabal's wrongdoing down on his own head." And then David sent word to Abigail, asking her to become his wife. His servants went to Carmel and said to Abigail, "David has sent us to you to take you to become his wife." She bowed down with her face to the ground and said, "I am your servant, and I am ready to serve you and wash the feet of my lord's servants." Abigail quickly got on a donkey and, attended by her 5 female servants, went with David's messengers and became his wife. David had also married Ahinoam of Jezreel, and they were both his wives. But Saul had given his daughter, Michal, David's wife, to Paltiel, son of Laish, who was from Galim.
Okay, 1 Samuel chapter 25, chapter 24, 25 and 26 are about the temptations of David. Before that, we had some of his tribulations, some of his trials and tribulations. But 24, 25 and 26, temptations. And it is through both of these, tribulations and temptations, that we grow and mature as Christians. We need both. We must be tempted. We must be tested if we're going to grow as Christians. So having looked at the trials and tribulations of David, we look in chapters 24 to 26 at his temptations. And we've got three very, very similar temptations. In all three temptations, the one in 24, the one in 25, and the one in 26, David is tempted to take revenge on an enemy. Now last time we looked at chapter 24, the first of these three temptations. It's a classic temptation, you'll remember. Totally unexpected, totally out of the blue. Saul, King Saul, actually wanders into David's cave. Alone. I mean, what are the chances of that? What were the chances of that happening? Well, it did happen. And David's men saw it as God's providence. The Lord has given him into your hand, David. What are you waiting for? If you're too squeamish to kill him, we'll do it for you. You just look the other way. Nothing to do with you. We'll get rid of him for you. But David says, no. He has to restrain his men from killing Saul. And instead of killing him, he just cuts off the fringe of his royal robe. And his conscience strikes him even for doing that. Because it was a royal robe. And cutting off the fringe of the royal robe was actually probably a claim to kingship. And David is conscience stricken even for having done that. And he allows his enemy Saul to walk out of that cave alive and well to continue the persecution. And David returns to his life on the run, waiting for God to deal with King Saul. When he shows Saul the bit of the robe that he cut off, Saul is conscience stricken for a short time. He even weeps crocodile tears, and he is emotionally moved by the experience, as you would be, I think. But it didn't last for very long. So that's chapter 24. In chapter 26, we've got a very similar incident. The difference between 24 and 26 is that it just happens in chapter 24. Saul wanders into David's presence in chapter 24. In chapter 26, David and his companion Abishai take the initiative and actually go into Saul's camp at night when they're all fast asleep. And David's companion urges him to pin Saul to the ground while he's there sleeping. His javelin, his spear is stuck in the ground by his head. And Abishai says to David, why don't you just take the spear and pin him to the ground? After all, Saul had actually tried to pin David to his palace wall on a number of occasions. But no, David simply takes Saul's spear and a water jar. And he says to Abishai, God will deal with Saul. Just look at chapter 26, verse 10. 26, verse 10. Verse 9. David said to Abishai, don't destroy him. Who can lay a hand on the Lord's anointed and be guiltless? As surely as the Lord lives, he said, the Lord himself will strike him. Either his time will come and he will die, or he will go into battle and perish. But the Lord forbid that I should lay a hand on the Lord's anointed. Now get the spear and water jug that are near his head and let's go. God will deal with him. He'll die in battle, or he'll just die. But let's leave him to God. So again, Saul has a very close shave. And again, when he realizes what has happened, he's temporarily moved. And he abandons his search for David. But not for very long. Chapter 27, verse 1. David thought to himself, one of these days I shall be destroyed by Saul. So, again, the impact that it had on Saul was very short-lived. Okay, so we've looked at chapter 24 and we've looked at chapter 26. Two very similar temptations. Sandwiched between these two incidents, is the incident that we've been looking at tonight. And again, in chapter 25, David is tempted to take revenge on an enemy. And this time, he's only prevented from doing so by God's grace and by God's providence and by God using a very wise woman as his instrument. So the story concerns a chap called Nabal, or Nabal. Probably Nabal is the correct way of pronouncing it, but I've always called him Nabal, so I'll probably call him Nabal tonight and just carry on doing that. So the story concerns Nabal and his wife Abigail. And Nabal is rich. The thing to remember about Nabal is that he is very, very rich. Verses 2 and 3 of chapter 25. A certain man in Maon who had property there at Carmel was very wealthy. He had 1,000 goats and 3,000 sheep which he was shearing in Carmel. His name was Nabal. So we're given a list of his possessions, a list of his riches, before we're even told his name. As one writer puts it, his possessions precede his person. Here is a man who was determined by his property. The thing, the great thing we know about Nabal is that he was rich. Now it seems that David and his men in the past had often protected Nabal's flocks from marauders. And they'd done so without ever enriching themselves. Verse 7. When your shepherds were with us, we did not ill-treat them, and the whole time they were at Carmel, nothing of theirs was missing. Verse 15. These men were very good to us, Abigail's servant says. They did not ill-treat us, and the whole time we were out in the fields near them, nothing was missing. Verse 16, night and day, they were a wall around us, all the time we were herding our sheep near them. So they protected Nabal's sheep from marauders. And now it was sheep shearing time, and sheep shearing time was traditionally a time of festivity and liberality. A time when you would expect a man like Nabal, who was absolutely loaded, to be generous. A bit like Christmas. I remember when the dustmen, they're not called dustmen now, are they? But when I was a lad, they were called dustmen. And I remember on just before Christmas, the dustman would come knocking on the door and just wish you a happy Christmas. And you'd think, that's nice of him. Nice of him to come and wish us a happy Christmas. And the boy who delivered the newspapers would do it as well. We'd get lots of people coming to the door and saying, happy Christmas. And you knew that you were expected, really, to give them something for Christmas. And we usually did. And David sends 10 men along to Nabal at sheep shearing time, when everyone was feeling absolutely generous and Nabal was loaded, after all. And these 10 men suggest that, maybe after all the protection that David has given free of charge through the year, he might like to think about showing his appreciation and giving a little something to David and his men. After all, there would be far fewer sheep to shear if it wasn't for David and his men. Well, Nabal might have been rich, but he was also a fool. In fact, his name means fool. I wonder why his mum called him that. And he's described in verse 3 as a surly or harsh and mean man. Now, when the Bible calls a man a fool, it doesn't mean that he's got a low IQ. There are fools in the Bible with very high IQs. There are fools today with very high IQs. A fool in the Bible is just somebody who can't see beyond themselves. They've got no real regard for God, no real regard for other people. All they can really see is themselves. There's one in the New Testament. Jesus called him the rich fool. He didn't have a low IQ, he had a pretty high IQ. He had done very, very well. He was a very successful man. But he forgot God. He forgot death. And he forgot his obligations to the poor. He filled his barns with stuff for himself, for his own retirement. And he couldn't care less about anybody else. That's what a fool is in the Bible. And Nabal was a fool. That's stressed throughout the chapter. Look at verse 17. His servant says, he's such a wicked man that no one can talk to him. Verse 25, his wife says, pay no attention to that wicked man Nabal. He is just like his name. His name is fool, and folly goes with him. And just look at how he dies at the end, verse 36. He was in the house holding a banquet like that of a king. He was in high spirits and very drunk. So the man's a fool. A rich fool. In fact, the only good thing about Nabal was his wife. He that finds a wife finds a good thing. And Nabal had found a good thing in marrying Abigail, who is described as an intelligent and beautiful woman. Okay, so David's men make this request, a pretty reasonable request, really. And what's Nabal's response to David's request? Well, look at verse 10 and 11. Verse 10, Nabal answered David's servants, who is this David? Who is this son of Jesse? So in fact, he does know who David is. He knows he's the son of Jesse. He knows quite a lot about David. So these are rhetorical questions. Doesn't mean he actually never heard of David. Who is this David? Who is this son of Jesse? Many servants are breaking away from their masters these days. Why should I take my bread and water and the meat I have slaughtered for my shearers and give it to men coming from who knows where? So he sends the 10 men home packing. He is totally dismissive of David. He completely writes David and his men off. Who is this man David? Who is this son of Jesse? Jesse was not a very impressive figure from the little town of Bethlehem. Why should I bother about the son of Jesse? He's a complete nobody. He's nothing but a runaway slave. Lots of slaves run away these days. Why should I bother with David? And according to the servant, Abigail's servant, he hurled insults at the 10 men. He hurled insults at them. So the 10 men went back to David and reported the situation to him. Funny, isn't it? You can cope with really big temptations. You can cope with Saul coming into the cave. I mean, King Saul, the man who's been persecuting you for years, with 3,000 men. And he comes into the cave. And David knows exactly what not to do. No, it would be wrong to kill him. Don't kill him. You can cope with obvious temptations. You can cope with big temptations. One old writer called Blakey, the Reverend Blakey, a Free Church of Scotland minister, he says, the servant of God may conquer in a great fight and yet be beaten in a small. In the presence of a great enemy, the utmost vigilance is maintained. Confronted by a great trial, we rally all our resources to bear it. It's in the comparatively small trials that we're actually liable to fall. Men, says Mr. Blakey, the Reverend Blakey, men may brave a dungeon or death itself, but can be defeated by a comparatively minor trial. Faced by this slight, this insult, David's immediate thought is revenge. Swords! Verse 13. Three times, actually, in the original. David said to his men, put on your swords. So they put on their swords. And David put on his sword, it says in the original. The NIV just doesn't like to use one word too often, even though it's there. About 400 men, 400 swords with David, while 200 stayed with the supplies. I mean, at least Saul hadn't written David off as a nobody. At least Saul hadn't ignored David. Saul actually thought David was worth 3,000 of his men pursuing for a number of years in the wilderness. Saul knew that David was the likely next king of Israel. Saul thought that David was worth pursuing relentlessly. But Nabal didn't give David the time of day. Who is this David? Who is this son of Jesse? It's the little slights. It's the little insults that really get under your skin, isn't it? David saw red. And now, at this crucial point, David is well on the way to becoming another Saul. Remember what happened in chapter 23? The massacre at Nob. The priests at Nob had helped David. They'd given him some bread. And they'd given him Goliath's sword. Saul turns up at Nob. And when he finds out that they've harbored David, they've helped him, they've sent him on his way with supplies, he has the whole town slaughtered, 85 priests, and then the whole town, men, women, infants and babies, it says. And David has a similar massacre in mind. Look at verse 34. As surely as the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, who has kept me from harming you, if you had not come quickly to meet me, not one male belonging to Nabal would have been left alive by daybreak. So David has a massacre in mind. But the massacre doesn't take place. Why not? Well, a very perceptive unnamed servant reports the situation to Abigail, Nabal's wife. He says, look, there's going to be a disaster here if you don't do something, verse 17. He doesn't even attempt to reason with Nabal directly, verse 17. He's such a wicked man, no one can talk to him. But he speaks to his wife. She's more reasonable. And he says, look, you've got to avert disaster. This is going to end in disaster for everybody. And so Abigail loses no time. Verse 18. Abigail lost no time. Verse 34. If you had not come quickly to meet me, not one male belonging to Nabal would have been left alive by daybreak. She lost no time. And without telling her husband what she was doing, she got together some goodies for David and his men. Verse 18, she took 200 loaves of bread, 2 skins of wine, 5 dressed sheep, 5 seers of roasted grain, 100 cakes of raisins, 200 cakes of pressed figs, and loaded them on donkeys. Not bad, eh? Not bad. And remember, there was probably a lot of partying going on at sheep shearing time. So this was just some of the food from the party. So she took a few donkey bags from the party. Doggy bags, isn't it? Sorry, not donkey bags. Doggy bags. She took a few doggy bags from the party for David and his men without telling her husband. And then she sends those ahead with her servants. She mounts a donkey herself. She goes out personally to meet David. When she meets him, she dismounts. She bows down before him with her face to the ground. She falls at his feet. She calls herself your servant. She calls him my master. And she asks for pardon. She asks for forgiveness. And she explains to David that her husband is a fool by name and a fool by nature. And what had happened had been completely unknown to her. And fools like her husband are not worth taking seriously. Only fools take fools seriously. There's a proverb somewhere about not answering a fool according to his folly. Only fools take fools seriously. And she goes on to give David some excellent advice. She says, look, David, your future is secure. You are safe. God is going to deal with your enemies. God's promise, Yahweh's promise, is reliable. She tells him some good stuff. Verse 29, even though someone is pursuing you to take your life, the life of my master will be bound securely in the bundle of the living by the Lord your God, but the lives of your enemies he will hurl away as from the pocket of a sling. When the Lord has done for my master every good thing he promised concerning him and has appointed him leader over Israel, my master will not have on his conscience the staggering burden of needless bloodshed or of having avenged himself. And when the Lord has brought my master success, remember your servant. So she says, David, your future is secure. God has promised that you will be the next king of Israel. Nobody can do anything to stop that. God is bigger than Nabal. So you must be bigger than Nabal. Your life, David, is precious to God. It's packed away in the bundle of the gods of the living. God's got you in his suitcase, as it were. You're one of his precious possessions. Those who oppose you, well, they are as disposable and they are as insecure as a stone in the pouch of a sling, which is just going to be hurled away. But God's not going to do that with you, David. He's got you in the bundle of the living. You're one of his precious possessions. And what a stain, David, on your reputation and on your conscience for the rest of your life this massacre would be. Verse 28. The Lord will certainly make a lasting dynasty for my master because he fights the Lord's battles. Let no wrongdoing be found in you as long as you live. Verse 31. My master will not have on his conscience the staggering burden of needless bloodshed or of having avenged himself. It's a magnificent speech, isn't it? Absolutely magnificent speech Abigail comes out with. And Abigail is only saying to David what David should have been saying to himself. Abigail is using the arguments that David should have been using in dialogue with his own sinful nature. This is an example of biblical counselor. Abigail was a biblical counselor, arguing from God's word, reasoning from God's word, giving someone who was about to do something reckless and wrong biblical arguments for not doing it, or for doing something else. And when she's finished, David recognizes her words as the words of God to her. Samuel the prophet might be dead, verse 1. That's how the chapter begins, Samuel's dead. That's how David normally got his words from God. But even though Samuel the prophet is dead, God still has his way of bringing his word to David. And but for this timely intervention from Abigail, David would just have been another Saul with a massacre on his conscience for the rest of his life. So God had sent him what Dale Ralph Davis calls a saviour in skirts. David had to be a totally different kind of king from King Saul and from any other Middle Eastern despot. And God prevented him or kept him from doing evil, from behaving like an Oriental or a Middle Eastern despot in this chapter. And that's repeated over and over again. Verse 26. Now since the Lord has kept you, my master, from bloodshed and from avenging yourself with your own hands. Verse 33, David says to Abigail, may you be blessed for your good judgment and for keeping me from bloodshed this day. Verse 34, otherwise as surely as the Lord the God of Israel lives, who has kept me from harming you. Verse 39, when David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, praise be to the Lord who has upheld my cause against Nabal for treating me with contempt. He has kept his servant from doing wrong and has brought Nabal's wrongdoing down on his own head. Four times in the chapter, we're told that God had kept David from committing this sin. So God used Abigail as his mouthpiece to David. And while we thank God for Abigail, let's also thank God for this unnamed servant who was in the right place at the right time and who acted as promptly as Abigail had acted by bringing Abigail's attention to the situation. And Dale Ralph David gives us one or two other examples of unnamed people being in the right place at the right time in the providence of God. Remember Naaman's little captive maid? We don't know her name. Remember Paul's nephew? Has anybody heard of Paul's nephew? You're looking as if you haven't heard of Paul's nephew. Acts chapter 23. Acts chapter 23 verse 16. Turn to Acts chapter 23 verse 16. There's a Jewish plot against the life of Paul. Page 1120. 2316. But when the son of Paul's sister, that's a nephew, isn't it? Yeah. But when the son of Paul's sister heard of this plot, he went into the barracks and told Paul. Then Paul called one of the centurions and said, take this young man to the commander. He has something to tell you. So he took him to the commander. Paul's nephew, the son of his sister, happened to be there at just the right time in the providence of God. So thank God for this unnamed servant of Abigail's as well. Okay, well, let's get on with the story. We're nearly finished. Sure enough, Abigail returns from reasoning with David, from counseling David, and tells her husband next morning what has happened. She doesn't tell him straight away because he's drunk. So she lets him sleep off his hangover and next morning tells him what has happened. And his heart fails him and he becomes like a stone. And 10 days later he's dead. He almost died of shock. I'm not sure what it was that shocked him exactly. Was it the danger that he'd been preserved from? Was it the fact that he'd lost some of his produce? I mean, all that produce? Was it the fact that his wife had actually stood up to him? But whatever it was, he was so shocked he died. He became like a stone and 10 days later the Lord struck him and he was dead. It was as easy as that. It was as straightforward for God to get rid of this man as that. David didn't have to do it. God did it. And so David praises the Lord in verse 39. When David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, praise be to the Lord who has upheld my cause against Nabal for treating me with contempt. And he has kept his servant from doing wrong and has brought Nabal's wrongdoing down on his own head. And the story has an even happier ending. It's a great story, this, isn't it? It has an even happier ending. They get married. And they live happily ever after. Well, maybe not. Because polygamy is never a good idea. He already had a wife. Not ideal to have another one. No one can serve two masters. No. Not ideal to have another one. And of course he had one or two others as well later on, and it all begins to unravel and go pear-shaped later on in David's life, and there are huge family conflicts involving the children of different wives. Never a good idea for anybody. I'll probably say a bit more about that next Sunday morning when we talk about the seventh commandment, you shall not commit adultery. Okay, some lessons from this story. One sentence lessons from this story. Lesson number one, listen to your wife. Listen to your wife. That's a lesson for the men, incidentally. Listen to your wife. If possible, get an intelligent and beautiful one. And listen to her. Especially in situations like this. You know what men are like? You know, macho, when they're insulted, when they're slightly humiliated, and they see red, like David did. Listen to your wife. Beware of small temptations. As the Reverend Blakey said, the big ones are sometimes easier to deal with. It's the small ones that catch us out. The souls are easier to deal with than the navel that really get under our skin. Be thankful to God for the sins that He's stopped you from committing, that He's prevented you, that He's kept you from committing. Who knows what they are? The sins you might have committed, but for the grace of God. Be thankful to those who have prevented you from sinning. Are there people who have given you a bit of advice and stopped you from sinning? Thank God for them. If you see someone heading for sin and heading for spiritual disaster, don't delay. Do something. Like Abigail did. Don't take revenge, even for those small insults and humiliations that really get under your skin. Don't take revenge. Let God deal with it. Romans chapter 12. Vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. Step back, leave room for the wrath of God. God is just. God will sort it out. You don't need to. You just get on with loving your enemy. If your enemy hungers, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him something to drink. Leave wrath and judgment to God. Trust him to do it. Be thankful for God's grace. But for the grace of God, there go I. Without God's grace, David would just have been another Saul. With a massacre on his conscience. Without God's providential grace. God's kingdom will come. We don't need to hurry it along by sinful methods. That's the lesson of this story. God's kingdom will come without us resorting to sinful, ungodly, unchristlike methods. I do wish the church had remembered that down through its history, and that there had been no crusades. I mean, the sort of crusades that happened in the Middle Ages. I'm not talking about Billy Graham crusades. I'm talking about knights on horseback going to the Promised Land to get Jerusalem back from the Muslims and all that sort of nonsense. We don't need to do that. We don't need to resort to ungodly methods to bring about God's kingdom. God is going to bring about His kingdom. It is absolutely secure. It is absolutely safe. His promises are certain. We don't need to resort to what He forbids in order to bring about God's kingdom. And finally, there is only one perfect king. Sadly, as we'll see as we go into 2 Samuel, David, in his older age, began to lose his grip on God. There's only one perfect king who never took revenge, who never repaid insult with insult. He was perfect. He was holy and completely good, the Lord Jesus Christ. He was holy and completely good. The insults were totally, totally wrong. And he could have taken a terrible revenge. He could have called for 12 legions of angels to come and rescue him from his enemy. But he never took revenge. Instead, says Peter, he committed himself to him who judges justly. He knew that his Father would see him right, would do what was just, would raise him from the dead, would glorify him, if he only obeyed his Father and did his Father's will. And if we are his subjects, we ought to behave like him. Amen.